From Beijing to Berlin, from Singapore to South Carolina, from Cape Town to Canada, the world turns on business and commerce. And where there is such industry, disagreements are bound to happen. Sometimes these disagreements are resolved. For the rest of the time, they end up in the capable hands of professionals around the world. The dynamic and interesting stories of these individuals is what you will hear on this show, Tales of the Tribunal. Greetings, hello, and welcome to the show. As that deep-voiced, bassy, smooth narrator just told you, you are listening to Tales of the Tribunal. I am your host, Chris Campbell, your captain, your navigator, your guide into these weekly deep dives into the personalities and backgrounds of the professionals that make up international dispute resolution. Now, you might be thinking, Chris, we came to hear about international litigation or arbitration. We came to hear about international mediation or other topics in international business. Well, dear listener, you have come to the right place. We will cover all of those topics and more. But first things first, on this inaugural episode of Tales of the Tribunal, we are going to cover the background and times of Ms. Lakshanti Fernando of CMS, who is a Singapore-based attorney who has a fascinating story about growing up in Sri Lanka, being of Sri Lankan heritage, and what that means to her today practicing in the wide world of international dispute resolution. If you will stick around after the show, we have some additional end notes and footnotes and things for you to look out for as we prepare for next week's episode. In any case, enough of my introduction. Thank you for tuning into this first episode, and we'll see you on the other side of the show. Welcome to Tales of the Tribunal. This is the next episode in our Vienna series of episodes that are taking place during the V-Smoot. I am your host, Chris Campbell. I am hosting this episode, Tales of the Tribunal, where we talk about the interesting personalities and people that make up this world of international dispute resolution. With me today, I have Ms. Lakshanti Fernando. Have I pronounced that right? Is that correct? Is that close?
That's very good, Chris.
Well, thank you. So, without me trying to do it, why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction? Who are you? Where are you from? What do the people need to know?
People may think they don't need to know very much, but I'm originally from Sri Lanka, and I live currently in Singapore, and I have lived in Singapore for about 15 years. I grew up in Colombo during the Civil War in Sri Lanka, so I had quite an interesting upbringing, as you tend to do when you grow up during a civil war.
Sure.
And my father is a linguist and my mother is an interior designer, and they are from two different races, which hence we had that whole civil war in Sri Lanka. So I really had quite an interesting upbringing, and I think that molded to a great extent who I am. My father was very keen on me becoming a lawyer. There were, you know, we had people in our family who were in law, and my dad was very keen that I go into law. My mother was keen that I go into medicine. I was the only child, so they had all their hopes and dreams pinned on me.
Sure, as parents do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I came to Singapore quite at their urging to consider Singapore at a time where most of my friends were going to the UK or to Australia or to the US for their higher education. And I, at my father's encouragement, applied to the National University of Singapore, which was quite a difficult university to get into at the time and still is.
Sure, quite renowned, yeah.
Yes, and I was told I was one of the first, if not their first, Sri Lankan undergraduate in the National University of Singapore's Faculty of Law. And I was surrounded by other Singaporeans, which was great because I built a community of Singaporean friends who are still my friends to this day. And I graduated at a time when you went into a big law firm and you did your training contract and your pupillage there, and I sort of rode the wave of arbitration and the rise of arbitration in Singapore and Singapore becoming a dispute resolution hub. So I was quite fortunate to graduate at the time that I did, and you know, the rest is history. I stayed on, and
sure.
I still very much enjoy living and working in Singapore. I consider it my second home.
Well, sure. So yeah, that's a lot to unpack. I mean, wow, what a story. So arbitration, I mean, what was it, the chicken and the egg? What did you come to CMS and then discover your interest in arbitration? Or was it your interest in arbitration first and then that led you to CMS and there from?
I always wanted to do litigation.
Okay.
I didn't even attempt a seat in the corporate department or any other department. I just did my training in litigation. I worked with litigators. And I had in my first arbitration case actually as lead counsel when I was about 25 or 26 years old. And that was really because I moved from a big local law firm to a boutique firm, and the partner I was working with was working on a number of arbitration cases, Singapore International Arbitration Center and HKIAC arbitration cases. In fact, my first case was an HKIAC case that we worked on together. And I just did both litigation and arbitration. I enjoyed both. They both had their advantages. They were both attractive in different ways. I enjoyed both in different ways. And I was always doing litigation and arbitration, even prior to joining up with Olswang and then now CMS as part of the merger.
Okay, so two firms. What was the first firm?
So I first started off in Kara Wong.
Right.
And then I moved to a boutique firm called Legal Standard. And I was there for about 6 years. And during that time, I headed up their arbitration team. And then I was a deputy managing partner of the firm for a couple of years before I decided to set off and do something else. And at that time, Olswang was a firm I'd been working with because international law firms are regulated in a certain way, so they don't practice Singapore litigation, for example. So I was doing work with Olswang while I was at my previous firm. And then when I decided to do something different, I set up a Singapore law practice that worked in association with Olswang.
Okay.
And so through that, I did court litigation and advised on Singapore law work. And then as part of the merger, which happened in 2017, Olswang merged with CMS Cameron McKenna. So we are now Cameron McKenna Nabarro Olswang.
Sure, it's a mouthful.
easily known as CMS now. We're now in a formal law alliance in Singapore, which basically means that we have the regulatory approval to operate as a formal law alliance, but Singapore law and litigation representation are done through the Singapore law practice, which we had set up in 2015 with Olswang. So from a branding perspective, our go-to-market is pretty much the same. We are CMS Hoban Asia. And arbitration is not regulated in the way litigation is, so international law firms can practice arbitration. But my work continues to be about 50-50,
sure,
arbitration and litigation.
But in either case, you knew you wanted to be up in front of, in some cases, the courtroom, sometimes in front of the arbitrators, doing oral advocacy. That's what your senses were leading you towards.
Yeah, that's what I was passionate about. And I do enjoy still very much the counsel role.
Sure.
That's all I wanted to do. That's why I went into law to begin with, was to be a litigator.
Right, yeah. Right. And so going from that, what are some of the, to the extent you can discuss what you're working on or what you have in the pipeline, what are some of the things that you're working on now, either directly at work or just kind of in the industry that you're interested in and excited about?
Yeah, I mean, our work is very varied, and that's the real, you know, joy of working in a place like Singapore, because it's such a hub. The work you're doing is not Singapore work, it's mainly regional work.
Sure.
And so we've done everything recently from a resort villa dispute in the Maldives, which is an ICC arbitration, to a cyber breach incident that involved multiple jurisdictions, to a fraud and corruption case that again involved a number of jurisdictions, to a shipping dispute. The work is so varied, and that's what keeps it very interesting. And the clients you're working with are across multiple jurisdictions, and you're working with counsel in multiple jurisdictions, opposing counsel and your local counsel, and I think that keeps the work very varied, and it keeps our associates as well very interested and driven about the work that they're doing, because it's so different from a day-to-day basis.
Sure, how many associates?
Well, we've got a relatively large team for an international firm in Singapore. I mean, we've got You're putting me on the spot here.
About a ballpark, you know, it doesn't need to be precise.
I think they're going to get annoyed with me if I get these.
You got to name them now.
We have about three senior associates in our disputes team. We have two counsel.
Okay.
And we have about five or six associates, I'm getting that number correctly. I'm probably not getting it wrong. But it's across infrastructure, construction, energy, commercial disputes, tech disputes. So we've got quite a broad team.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned a couple of specific industries just now, and then in your explanation a moment ago. Are there any of those industries that you gravitate towards more than the others, some that you really like? Do you like oil and gas and energy, for example, or maybe shipping? Let us understand that a little bit.
It's funny because I started off as a shipping lawyer.
Okay.
So I still have clients from the shipping and marine industry, and I find them really interesting clients. A lot of them are very successful at what they do, and they have had no formal education, but they're businessmen, and I find them very interesting to know and very inspiring people and quite interesting characters. So I've got my shipping clients. I'm generalizing, of course, but they've got their own. It's getting to know them on a personal level is very interesting. And then I've got media clients, and I find the media industry as well very interesting. We work with a number of big broadcasters and industry players, and of course their sector is constantly changing, and their in-house teams are very interesting people as well. People who go into media are quite interesting by nature, and that's very varied. We work a lot with energy and oil and gas clients, and they're interesting too. I mean, it's just so varied, but often it's a mixture of working with in-house legal teams and sometimes directly with the business owners. And one of the benefits of working in I'm saying Asia in general, but in Singapore, and coming from a boutique law firm practice, that I've gotten to know people who actually run the business and who have built the business.
Sure.
So when you go into a litigation, for instance, we had a litigation which involved a marine accommodation company. You get to know the actual business owners, and you know that if this case doesn't go their way, they could potentially, it means everything to them because they've built this business from scratch. And it has a personal element to it, which I think that is important, and not, we shouldn't lose touch with, especially in litigation. We shouldn't lose touch with what it means to people and fundamentally to their livelihoods. And to their legacies sometimes. And I think that's really, it's really nice to do that and work with that and not just do things from a purely corporate angle.
Sure. So it sounds like, well, one, it sounds like you're busy.
Yeah.
But yeah. Two, I mean, it sounds like you truly get to see both sides, both the business aspect and being integral to the business, but also the legal aspect, the more procedural and substantive legal arguments. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's very varied, but I think clients are increasingly looking for lawyers it's more than just knowing the law.
Sure.
It's about, you know, the EQ, it's about being commercial, it's about being savvy, it's about knowing, you know, how to manage not just them, but manage your opposing counsel, and see things that they haven't seen before, and spot issues that they haven't spotted before. And it's also, we're going away from those stack of legal memos and, you know, having the sort of very risk averse advice where we say maybe, possibly, you could probably do that.
Right.
To having to give those yes or no answers, and also having to work with the business where budget is coming from, and it's not just from a legal budget, but you're working with the business, and you know that the legal that you're working with has to justify this to the business. And I think that we as private practice lawyers have to become so much more commercial, and there's obviously has to be greater awareness of technology and how that's playing a role in this as well, AI and all of that. Although I think litigation
coming to take our jobs, right?
I think it's going to be difficult with litigation because there's still very much of a human element to it, with judges, with arbitrators, with your own counsel. There is a human element to that, which I don't think that will be replaced that easily. That's my personal view. You can't just automate that.
Yeah. Well, we'll save the interview for the next 20 years and see. You know, maybe this is my job. Maybe it's the host of this show is automated at that point. But I digress. So you know, it sounds like one, because you're so entrenched into your work and you have so many things going on. Maybe this next question is somewhat of a loaded one. Do you have time for extracurriculars in the industry, in the field? How do you keep your time busy there?
Well, I think I do things which maybe not necessarily always connected to the law, but I am, as you are already aware, I do a lot in the diversity and inclusions front. We have a number of initiatives that we do in Singapore, and I think that is obviously something that I'm passionate about. I would do regardless of being a lawyer or not, but because I'm in this position, it gives me an opportunity to do something specifically for the legal sector. So we have an initiative which we run with Microsoft, which is called Women Leap. It's a network for women in legal, executive, advisory, and professional roles in Singapore, which we started in 2015, and we've had a series of events every year. We wanted to create a forum for women to network, to collaborate, to share their stories in a candid way. And not just for women, but for women to bring along their male colleagues and sponsors and allies and create a forum that was full of sponsorship and mentoring and creating that kind of community in Singapore. And we've gotten a lot of traction with that, and we're immensely proud of it and happy with how it's gone. I'm also involved in the Singapore Sri Lanka Business Association Executive Committee, and that is really, Singapore and Sri Lanka have historically had very close ties, and this is an association which is purely non-profit. And in that role, we're looking to do various things. One of the initiatives this year that we're planning to run is a startup accelerator series, to connecting Sri Lankan startups with investors and investors in Singapore, for example, and through a program of mentorship as well. So they have a panel of mentors who would assist those startups that were going to make it, in a way, through an application process with financial planning, with how do you pitch, with how do you put your business plan together, legal, regulatory mentorship as well. And so that's something that we're hoping to roll out over the course of the next 12 months. And also in that, sort of not in that role, but it's my own personal passion and project is also involving Sri Lankan designers, immensely talented people in the fashion industry in Sri Lanka who haven't really taken their brands international. And we're trying to create a platform for them to be able to do that. Singapore is obviously a great market for them, a regional hub for them. And if they could launch somewhere in Singapore, that would be fantastic. So I'm working with some designers in Sri Lanka and on doing something in that space as well, and hopefully take their brands out of the domestic market into a more international market in the region.
Okay, next question. When do you sleep? I mean, you know, you just listed off a huge number of things that you do professionally, but also it sounds like you're quite busy in the extracurricular atmosphere as well. A little more serious, but the question would then become, it sounds like you really are invested or committed to involving Sri Lankan businesses and enterprises in the Singaporean space, but just connecting all of that to the greater international community. Is that kind of how you see it, or, you know, what's your...
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud to be Sri Lankan.
So.
We have an amazing history. We have gone through very rough times during the civil war. We had an immense amount of potential as a country, and I think I'm placed in a fortunate position where I can do something to help. My parents still live in Colombo. I still go back to Sri Lanka very often. I'm doing more and more, you know, on the legal side with lawyers in Sri Lanka. Just recently went down to speak as a keynote speaker when they launched their committee for the professional development of women lawyers in Sri Lanka, to keep women in litigation effectively, and also to promote arbitration as well in Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka is well positioned to be a hub if it got its infrastructure right, if everything worked and the dots were connected, it would be a very well positioned. And I think that as a country, it has an immense amount of potential. And it takes people like us who are educated, who've had the benefit of going out into the world and working elsewhere, to take that experience and go back and do something positive in the country, and a number of my friends have done the same thing, and they now live in Sri Lanka. I still live in Singapore, but it's only 3 hours, 45 minutes away
from Sri Lanka. Yeah, short, real quick.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Singapore and Sri Lanka have had historically, as I mentioned, very good ties. So I think to be that bridge would be fantastic. And I obviously am very passionate about the country, and I think it has a lot to also to look to its neighbors like Singapore and emulate as well, and progress, because there is a very highly educated population. We had the first female prime minister in the world. We're the first country, I believe, in Asia to give women the vote in 1931. So we have a very, you know, there is a lot of intellect and intelligence and education and creativity and talent in the country. And we're just trying to do something as a business community in Singapore to assist that and support that.
Now, I'd be curious to know if there have been any challenges or any pushback, because when we talk about diversity and inclusion, we think of it in at least a couple of different ways, but two of the most primary ways are, you know, gender diversity and inclusion, first of all, but also ethnic and cultural diversity and inclusion. And sometimes those things are interlinked, and it's difficult to do both at the same time, especially. What has that experience been like? Or have there been any sort of pushback or any sort of challenges to meeting those goals?
I think that's a really great question. I think that when we have our panels and when we do initiatives, we try to cover as much as we can. But sometimes you don't have enough time, or you think it might get too convoluted or distracting if you try to cover too much. But I think it's important to understand that diversity is not just gender diversity. It's also ethnic diversity. It's also our skills and physical abilities as well. It's creating an inclusive culture across the piece, across religion, across, you know, everything, that we just want to make sure that we're not just focused just on gender diversity in our conversations, because it's so much more than that.
Sure.
But I don't think there is any real pushback in that sense, because those, I feel, who come to these initiatives and
right.
come to these panels are already the converted.
Yeah, that'd be kind of weird, right? I'm against this.
Or hopefully the soon to be converted.
Right.
But I always say that the business case for diversity is the best way to get people who may not be converted yet or may not be so sensitive or aware across the line. Because statistically, there is enough data to show that the more diverse an organization is, the more diverse management is across the board, the more profitable it is, the better financial hygiene it has, the least corrupt it is, you know? So there is enough data to show that as an organization, you will perform better if you are more diverse. And if there isn't a better reason for diversity, if you're not converted, that should be a good reason to convert to it, because it's not just the right thing to do, but it also yields tangible results. That's part of the conversations that we're having, where we are talking about the business case for it as well. And I think that's important, especially when you're doing this in a corporate sphere. You do need to talk about the data and the statistics, because I think that gives you a lot of power, and it's a powerful tool.
Sure. You know, shifting focus just a little bit to, I guess, earlier your career to maybe things that are relevant now. Who are some of the influential figures or mentors or people that have been guiding forces, if any, in your career so far? People that you've looked up to?
Well, of course, my parents.
Sure.
But also, my husband has been extremely supportive of my career. I wouldn't be where I am, I think, without his support and understanding, and also his own ambition. I think that drives you as well.
Is he a lawyer too?
No.
Okay.
Thank
goodness. You get to leave the law at the office, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
But you know, I think that's important, because you know, you need to have that support as well as at home, and in my career, I've had a number of mentors and sponsors. I like to use the term sponsors. I think sponsorship is very important.
Sure.
And I have had the benefit of in my boutique practice that I work with, working with some fantastic people who are still to this day my good friends. And in my current organization, I've benefited a lot from people who have really advocated for me, who've lobbied for me, particularly when you're sitting somewhere out in Singapore.
Right.
You know, having those sponsors in London is really important, and it's really helps your career. And also just, you know, having people you can talk to and you can bounce ideas off and who've been there and done that, and you can learn from their experience and their savvy in navigating challenging situations. And also I feel that, you know, people who've you have female sponsors, you have male sponsors, you have people with the same, I mean, I've not really had a Sri Lankan, you know, living in Singapore, who went to law school, National University of Singapore, as someone, I don't know such a person.
Sure.
As a sponsor, but I've benefited from sponsors who have come from very different socioeconomic backgrounds and, you know, cultural background to me, but it doesn't prevent them from being a sponsor or a mentor, because in all it takes is really someone who believes in you, who sees your potential, who wants to invest in you, and who is going there and has skin in the game for you and is advocating for you. So I think that's really important, and I've benefited from that immensely in my career.
Well, that is a really profound point that you bring up, Lakshanthi, because the data itself pairs out in the United States that something like 6% of the black legal population in the United States is black. So, and so that means that there's just a very small pool of role models that you potentially have, because 6% of people that are potentially in your field. So that point that you've just made resonates a lot with me, because especially in the world of international arbitration, international dispute resolution, that pool gets even smaller from the totality of American lawyers. So it's important for that inclusion piece to be there, for people to sponsor you and intentionally be there to help you get into that field.
Well, I was profiled in the Global Arbitration Review, GAR.
Yes.
When the whole merger happened, and it was mentioned in there that I'm from Sri Lanka, and I had a number of lawyers write to me who are Sri Lankan living in other countries who are in arbitration.
Sure.
Saying, oh, it's fantastic, you're from Sri Lanka, and I understand where you're coming from, because I realized there was this little community, a small community.
That's right, yeah.
Spread across the world, and the fact that I was in Sri Lankan was their biggest takeaway from that whole article.
Yeah.
Was the fact that I was Sri Lankan. So I thought that you know, that shows how important it is. And when I go back to Sri Lanka, and I've made numerous trips back now over the past 2 years in particular, especially with women. I mean, when they see a connection, I'm a Sri Lankan female lawyer who has gone overseas and is doing international arbitration. There's a lot of interest in arbitration in Sri Lanka. And there are some challenges that women face in going to court in Sri Lanka, going to litigation there, because of the infrastructure and issues and you know, challenges that they uniquely face as women going to court. And arbitration is now an alternative for them.
Right.
And going into a less adversarial system, but, you know, it's the infrastructure might be different, and the challenges that they face in court, they may not face in international arbitration. Also, the kind of work that they would be doing would be very different as well. So I think I've seen almost arbitration in a different light to what I thought I would. So in those conversations I've been having with women in Sri Lanka, it's not just about mentorship, it's not just about creating equality, it's about creating an alternative path now for women advocates who still want to go and, you know, who still very much want to be counsel and be involved in advocacy, but they may not necessarily want to go to court as much. So I've seen arbitration promoted now in a different way in those communities. And that's been great to see. And I didn't really expect that, but it's been a pleasant, you know, surprise.
So you've really been able to weave, you know, a major cause or mission in your life into your work. I mean, that's amazing.
It comes organically, I think. And it comes from, I guess, listening to people when you're on the ground. And seeing opportunities which you may not have seen otherwise.
Well, that's right. And again, shifting just a little bit. So, you know, you're doing all this extracurricular stuff. You're killing it in your job. You're doing all of these things. How do you maintain that mental and physical balance? You know, some people like to go to the gym. Some people like to meditate. You know, how do you take care and maintain that sort of balance?
Well, my faith is very important to me. I find going to church is my way of, you know, reconnecting and sort of grounding myself a bit. And I think that's very important. It has always been important in my life. Also, you know, working out, you know, sure. Just, you know, having an outlet. If I don't work out, I find myself more lethargic and sort of not as, you know, just more frustrated in general. So I try to work out regularly in Singapore, which is easy to do because of the weather and because everyone in Singapore tends to be working out anyway. So I think we're all driven to do that. And just traveling as well, taking time off, and when we go on holiday, trying not to work.
Sure.
You know, putting your phone in the safe.
And what we all try and do, right? Yeah.
Locking it. And I went to Cuba recently, and that was great because there was no data roaming, so I could just. And you know what? One of my actually one of our global heads said to me once. He said, "You know what? Nothing bad is going to happen. You know, you can switch off and the world will still function and it'll be okay." So he was right, because I went 5 days without the internet, without data roaming. And even when I could get Wi-Fi, I didn't want to.
Right. And it's expensive in Cuba. Yeah.
It's expensive. That was one of the reasons. But, and, you know, being able to switch off, I think, is really good. So that's how we try to keep our balance in the family.
Sure, no, yeah. I think those are all great tips. Okay, we're going to do just a couple of sort of rapid-fire questions, you know.
It's like the Ellen Show.
Well, right, exactly. So, you know, if you don't have any kind of answer, you know, feel free to say pass.
Yeah, pass.
What non-law-related things are you reading right now?
Gosh, I'm still getting through Michelle Obama's book.
Oh, Becoming.
Becoming. I'm still getting through it.
That's a whole book. There's a lot in there. Yeah. Okay. So you're reading that. What kind of music are you into, or are you listening to? What is giving you life these days in terms of music?
I just listen to anything and everything.
Anything and everything.
I do like their soundtrack for A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born.
I do like the soundtrack for Green Book.
Oh, yeah.
Which I've been listening to, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Those are all good things. And last movie you saw, if you remember?
Was actually The Green Book.
The Green Book,
On Singapore Airlines.
Best picture.
Flying over, yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough.
I had mixed feelings about whether I wanted to watch it because of the controversy around
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah.
But it's a really good book, and they were great performances, yeah.
Now, did you see when they were filming it, I guess it would have been a couple years ago now, all the Crazy Rich Asian stuff when it was going to Singapore?
Gosh. I watched it thrice.
Really? Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And okay, well, that was fun. Good little rapid fire section, you know, to see, non-law-related information. So I do have just a couple final questions for you. So say you're approached, you get an email, or you run into someone at an event like the Wiesmuth, and it's a student that's getting ready to graduate, or maybe it's a lawyer that's just a couple of years into their career, and they want to break into international arbitration. They say, like, Shanti, you know, I've heard you're a great international arbitration practitioner. I'm trying to be like you. I'm trying to get where you're at. How do you tell them? What advice do you give them?
Well, in general, I give the advice to those who have interned with me and associates is just to follow your passion. Do what it is that drives you and gives you energy and that you enjoy, because it's very hard to be mediocre if you're doing something that you enjoy. Don't follow the money or the title. I know it's easier said than done, but I truly believe that money will come to you and the title will come to you if you're doing what you enjoy, because you'll be killing it. And in arbitration, and as in any, I think in any area of law or otherwise, it's working with the right people, especially early on in your career, working with people who will challenge you, who will give you opportunities, who will let you step up to be, you know, first chair on cases that, you know, you're comfortable doing and they're comfortable with you doing and the client is comfortable with you doing. And that's really what benefited me, because I worked in a boutique firm with someone who was perfectly happy for me to take on that role and to be client facing and to run cases with his support and supervision, but gave me the opportunity to do that. And I think that's really important because you really need to cut your teeth at it. And it's good to do that early on in your career. Because you learn from mistakes as well, but you also want to have that supervision and support while you're starting out. And I think that's really important.
Okay. And one more question before we get ready to wrap up. What are you looking forward to, law-related or not law-related, in the rest of 2019?
What am I looking forward to? I don't know what I'm looking forward to.
Another vacation.
I was thinking, is the U.S. election coming up?
No, not yet. That's 2020.
Yeah, no, that'll be next year. That I'll be looking forward to.
Real life house of cards. That's right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. This is our final question. Do you have any shout outs that you want to give to folks that might be listening, or, you know, just any shout outs in general?
Well, I'll give a shout out to my parents because they'll have to listen.
Hey, all right. Yeah, okay. Mama and Daddy Fernando. All right. Okay. The parents, okay. We'll leave it there then.
Yeah, and my husband, Tim.
Okay, Tim. All right. Shout outs. All right. Well, Lakshanthi, thank you for coming through. We'll have to have you again on the show again sometime. And thanks for your time.
Thank you, and all the best with everything.
Absolutely. Right, so that was my conversation with one Miss Lakshanthi Fernando, and that too was also episode one of Tales of the Tribunal. We have not been canceled yet. You're still listening, and I hope that you enjoyed the show. You may have heard me mention that this is, quote, the next episode in the Vienna series. That's because when we were recording this, we were recording a ton of interviews at the time. This is technically the first episode, so there will be subsequent episodes to come. That will be episodes 2, 3, and so on. If you enjoyed the show, I hope that you'll let me know about it. You can find me on LinkedIn as Chris Campbell. There are tons of Chris Campbells. I'm not even the only one in international arbitration, but if you type in Chris Campbell with the search terms South Carolina and international arbitration or something of the likes, I should hopefully come up. If you'd like to write to the show directly, write me at talesofthetribunal@gmail.com. It's spelled just like it sounds, talesofthetribunal@gmail.com. When you're writing about it on LinkedIn or any other social media, use the hashtag TOT, Tales of the Tribunal. And we will see you next week, where we'll have another show examining another guest. Typically in these endnotes and footnotes, we will give a spotlight or a quick rundown of upcoming events in international arbitration. So when you tune in next week, look for that. All of that said, again, I hope that you enjoyed the show. Thank you for tuning in. And there's no disputing it. You've just listened to Tales of the Tribunal, and we'll see you next week.